Cape Boot Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Scanner Foundation's 32nd annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the River in Portland. This year, Nelson Senior Vice President of U.S. Strategic Community Alliances and Consumer Engagement, Cheryl Grace, will be the keynote speaker. Grace has been with Nelson for 13 years, and for the past 7 years has overseen the production of a report on Black consumers, and will speak about the power of the Black dollar. Again, that's the Scanner Foundation's 32nd annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast on Monday, January 15th at 8:30 a.m. at the Red Line Hotel on the River, 909 North Hayden Island Drive in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock in the a.m., which means it's time for Valley Views. We have part two of the discussion with Richard Heinberg, senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute, on his article, Are We Doomed? Let's talk. So let's get right to it.
Hi, I'm Dale Holliday, coming to you from Corvallis, Oregon, in the bountiful Willamette Valley. Welcome to my show, Valley Views, a forum for sharing relevant topics relating to people and issues in the Willamette region. Hello, people. Please join me now for part two of my conversation with Richard Heinberg, senior fellow with the Post-Carbon Institute. This show is called Planet Earth in Hospice. I hope you enjoy.
Well, I have to speak about some of my upbringing, I guess I could say. Yeah. I grew up in a working class family. My dad was a truck driver and my mom a homemaker, and we really did not have a lot of dough, you know? It was a struggle sometimes. Yeah. And I think, though, because of that, we learned to use what we had, and we learned to protect what we had to make it last a little longer. And we also learned how to do without certain things. And so I guess some of that stuck with me, because as an adult, I really feel like I'm comfortable not buying a lot of stuff. And when I've had the fortune to spend some time in the country, the nation of Bhutan.
Oh, how wonderful.
Yeah, I did some work there and as a planner. And folks probably hear a train going by right now. That's wonderful. A little sound effect. Yeah. But we'll keep going here. For people that don't know, they are the land that developed the concept of gross national happiness as opposed to a gross national product. Their fourth king, who is still alive and well, although his son is now the king there, the fourth king developed this concept. And while I was there, I did see that there was an attempt to involve this concept into their lives, at least certainly through the government documents. Every planning document that I saw and that I worked on in policy had something about gross national happiness, and there are four major prongs of it. I can't remember them off the top of my head. But when you would look at the review these documents, you had to review them against the concepts of gross national happiness. And I'm not saying that they have it right. I mean, certainly they have their problems, and they do have environmental problems. And they, too, now, especially their young people, are wanting, they see the world. I mean, they have internet, they have cell phones, and they, too, now want to grow. So that's a big kind of pull and push there right now. However, the gross national happiness, I've seen other countries try to implement it. They might call it something else, but it seems like there's at least pockets of it around the world where people are trying something new.
Yeah, yeah, and that's, I think it's a really hopeful project that they've embarked on in Bhutan. I was at the United Nations about 3 or 4 years ago when they proposed the adoption of gross national happiness on a broader scale for general planning purposes across all nations, which I think would be a fantastic idea. GDP is a dead end. You know, we can only increase GDP so far. And, you know, you were talking about when you grew up as a kid. Well, you know, GDP in the United States is, I'm sure, two or three times what it was in those days, you know, whether it was two, three, four decades ago, I don't know. But are we two or three times happier than we were then? I think people in the United States are increasingly miserable right now. Why? Because of increasing economic inequality, because of the sense that the country is just not going in a very good direction. And, you know, our smartphones and all these things aren't really, you know, they do things for us and we get addicted to them, but they don't actually make us happy.
Right. They don't really add to that quality of life, that richness of life.
If we were aiming for good governance, quality of interconnection in our communities and intergenerational connection and these things that actually do give us life satisfaction, we could achieve those things without consuming more stuff. And that's where we have to get to. As long as GDP is tied to our sense of, you know, are we doing a good job or not? Are we, you know, being satisfied or not? Well, if not, then the problem is we got to have more GDP. We got to grow. We got et cetera. As long as we're on that track, we're headed toward a cliff, basically.
Yeah.
But if we're aiming for greater satisfaction in our communities, our families, our households, then there are lots of things we can do. Cultural events, you know, farmers markets, more local production for local consumption. So you know the people who make your stuff and you have more of a sense of investment in your own community. That's what makes people happy. And it also, you know, it makes our lives better in all sorts of tangible ways.
Yeah, and you know, I do see a lot of that going on here in Corvallis because it's a small enough city where you can sort of have that happening. And we have a farmers market that goes pretty much year round. I know in late November they'll go over to the county fairgrounds and they'll have it indoors for a while. But I've seen a move of this more local connections and. Especially in this political climate, it seems that there's a lot more conversation about that, how to do more grassroots growth and not just growth, not just social growth, but just kind of doing it for yourself.
Yeah. That's not a panacea. You know, we are going to have to make some bigger changes to our way of life beyond just, you know, localizing the economy. Getting off of fossil fuels is going to be an enormous task. And, you know, a lot of people don't think that population growth is a problem anymore, but, you know, globally we're adding on a net basis over 80 million people a year. We're adding 1 billion new people to the world's population every 12 years. So that makes all the other environmental problems that much harder to solve, whether we're talking about resource depletion or climate change or biodiversity loss.
Yes.
All of that just gets harder and harder as we keep growing the human population. So if we could get that trend going in the other direction, it would help enormously.
You know, maybe that's what, you know, I haven't read your article for about a month now. I first saw it in July. And maybe you just made me smile. You know, maybe that was the real hook because most people won't go there. And I'm just going to out myself here. I am child-free by choice. And that was a choice I made many, many years ago. And it wasn't even really to do with overpopulation. But now that I've done this, I feel very good about it. And sometimes such folks are viewed as kind of pariahs, and I'm not making judgment or anything, but that's just the way I roll. So
I totally know what you mean. My wife and I are also child-free, and we made the decision based on our awareness of overpopulation. And you know, it's been a challenge in the sense that we have to deal with expectations of other people, including family.
Yes.
that, you know, if you don't have children, is there something wrong with you?
Or perhaps you're selfish, or there's a whole laundry list of things.
Yeah, it's a taboo that we really have to deal with as a society.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Well, I think we're drawing close to a close, but I'd love to give you an opportunity to tell the audience if there are ways of seeking out more information about your institute or any websites or links you'd like to share.
Absolutely, yeah. If folks want to read more of my stuff, they can just go to richardheinberg.com. And if they want to know more about Post Carbon Institute, we have a website called resilience.org, O-R-G, that is updated on a daily basis and has just fantastic articles from all over the world about things that people are doing to, you know, nudge us more in the directions we've been talking about.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you again, Richard. It's been a great conversation, and I look forward to seeing you again in a touching basis.
Well, thank you, Dale. I've enjoyed it, too.
Okay. Take care now.
Mm-hmm.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Valley Views. I'm your host, Dale Holliday, and I'd love to hear from you. Comments, questions, ideas for future topics, or other matters you'd like explored. Email me at valleyviews@kboo.org. That's ValleyViews at kboo.org. I look forward to being with you again next time. And remember, as Doctor Who once said, I'm not in charge, but I'm full of ideas. Bye.
But I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land.
Hi, I'm Shaheed Hamid, KBOO board member. As we embark upon a new year, the World Arts Foundation and KBOO want to continue to honor the life and legacy of the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. On Monday, January the 15th, from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., the World Arts Foundation presents its 33rd consecutive tribute to this great American hero and advocate for peace, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Monday, January the 15th, at the Highland Christian Center. Speakers, African drumming, and a variety of musical performances, also broadcast live here on KBOO Radio. A tribute to the life and legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Where do we go from here? As people, as family, as community. Monday, January 15th, at 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Highland Christian Center, 7600 Northeast Gleason. Keep alive the dream.
Coming up next on KBOO Portland, where you are currently tuned, is Flashpoints, generously shared with us by the good folks at KPFA in Berkeley and the Pacifica Radio Network. We welcome this opportunity to check in with our siblings in struggle, regional solidarity with the San Francisco Bay Area. They help us check in with all of our siblings in struggle all around the world, from whence you can tune in at kboo.fm. And all that is possible because of the financial support of your friends and neighbors and a bunch of people you've never met, and some people you might not like very much. But we've all got this in common. We all recognize how crucially important it is to have an electronic media outlet that serves no one's needs but yours, because it is supported and funded and generated by no one but you and your friends and neighbors. So let's check in now.
and you're listening to Flashpoints. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We return to the decision by the Trump administration to end temporary protected status for some 200,000 Salvadorans. We want to talk about that in the context of history, the U.S. history with El Salvador and with Central America. It's a violent history, and it's the reason why so many Central Americans are in the U.S. And joining us to talk about this is Professor Joseph Nevins. He's a professor of geography at Vassar College. His books include Dying to Live, A Story of U.S. Immigration in an Age of Global Apartheid. Professor Nevins, welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us. You know, I've been thinking about our interview today and remembering what I was doing at the end of 1985, I believe it was, into 86. I could have the year wrong, but I was covering the Tucson Sanctuary trial. I believe it was the end of 85. And it was about these 12 nuns and church workers who were on trial for helping to create the sanctuary movement, which was giving aid to the victims of U.S.-supported death squad wars in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Honduras. And that southern border became the direct barometer of the intensity of the wars we were prosecuting down south. And I remember I was